The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week, and I'm delighted because he's a pal of mine, is Albany County District Attorney David Soares. David Soares has served as head of the District Attorneys Association of New York State and has been the Albany County District Attorney since 2005. Prior to serving as District Attorney, he was Assistant District Attorney in Albany County and Albany County's first community prosecutor. D.A. Soares is a graduate of Cornell University, Albany Law School, and welcome my friend, D.A. Soares.
How are you?
Well, I'm all right. So I'm going to ask you something. How is it going in terms of the relationship between the state and the district attorney? I have some anger in me towards the way in which the district attorney's offices have been treated, particularly in Albany, which is supposed to prosecute the bums when they get out of line. And they don't give you a lot of money to run your office with.
You know, I think for prosecutors across the state, we've become victims of our own success. I mean, New York State enjoys a status of being the safest large state in the entire country. And in terms of rankings, we only rank below states like South Dakota and other states that have very little population. So I think over the years, we've been doing something right. And when I say we, I mean it takes a community of people who are vested in safety. It takes, you know, committed law enforcement and then, you know, prosecutors who do the work. And so as a result of being one of the safest states, I think people have gotten a bit too comfortable and have abandoned some of the goals that I think we in public service and specifically in public safety have remained committed to.
Well, David Soares, I'm fascinated by what you say about safety, because if you read the tabloids and if you read the hometown newspaper in Albany or Schenectady, they always play up some drive-by shooting or somebody who did something really awful. So are we really that safe?
Well, look, I mean, I live in a small bedroom community, and, you know, the worst things that happen in our community are deer that happen to get in people's trash or, you know. But the reality is mere miles away from where I live, you have, you know, the cycle of recycled violence, right? And you have people who were shot at on Saturday who then turn around on Tuesday and go back and look for revenge. So the reality here is that in pockets of our communities, it is we still have a lot of work to do, but that work must also involve more prevention strategies. It must involve more investments, because people that have something to live for generally aren't out there trying to harm one another.
What do you mean by strategies, by prevention strategies?
Well, let's look at Albany as a perfect example. I mean, the police obviously are doing their work because they're arresting people who carry weapons. We're obviously doing our job because we're prosecuting those individuals. But this is not the way to completely restore peace in some of these communities. You know, the vast majority of the shooters in my community in calendar year 2019 are 15 and 16 and 17 year olds. Wow. Now, you have to ask yourself the question, why are 15, 16 and 17 year old kids, you know, out there with weapons harming one another and harming their community? And the only answer to that is, well, they may not have anything else to hope for or to live for. And I think that if we're going to talk about public safety, we must also begin having the discussion about prevention, and we have to invest more in prevention. And that's where I see the state, and that's where I see, you know, leadership that quite honestly, you know, they need to pick up and deliver. We have an obligation to our urban centers, and we have an obligation to invest in our urban centers, and that needs to happen.
So, you know, we've been seeing these terrible tragedies of all of these mass shootings, and quite often, as you just have suggested, it's somebody of a fairly youngish age, in their early 20s, for example. Have you thought about what's creating that?
Well, you know, I think it's the proliferation of very dangerous weapons that we have on, you know, that's readily available to people, and that should scare people. I mean, I think that most of us who commute to work every day, you know, when we can lay on the horn, sometimes we find ourselves not laying on the horn because we have concerns about the reaction that we're going to get from some other person. So we're always concerned about the stability of other people. And that's just honking the horn, right? But we seem not to have the same concern when it comes to keeping dangerous weapons out of the hands of the same individuals that we express concerns about during routine, you know, traffic interactions. And I think that that has to change. But I'm glad you asked the question, because oftentimes I think we get into this habit of trying to, you know, solve this problem as if it's one problem. Let's be very clear here, right? We hear about mass shootings because mass shootings are newsworthy, and there's a lot of reporting on mass shootings. But let's look at the city of Chicago, right? That several weeks ago, their hospitals were stressed to the outer limits because there were too many shootings that occurred over the course of one weekend. And so urban violence, urban shootings, it is mass shootings, and we should be just as concerned about that as we are about, you know, assault weapons. And I'd like to see more, news outlets and more people having that dialogue. But I also want to hear from people who live in those communities and have to live under that constant stress.
Recently, there has been an attempt by the governor and the legislature to basically put some more, I don't want to say onus, on the district attorneys in terms of their own, and put an overlayment over them. You guys fought that. The district attorneys fought it. Can you tell us what the whole thing was all about?
Yeah, you know, the governor and the legislature believed in their infinite wisdom that they should create a body that provides oversight over prosecutors, except for the fact that there already is a body that provides oversight over all lawyers. That body is housed under the appellate division for all departments throughout the state. So they're the licensing authority, and they're the authority that provides, services for purposes of grievances that are filed. The governor and the legislature, in an effort to, put a political feather in their cap, decided to create a commission on prosecutorial conduct. Now, here, for the record, let's just be very, very clear here. I'm not disagreeing with the fact that we need to have a much more aggressive grievance body, that people can file complaints and make sure that they hear back from those bodies when those complaints are filed. It should also be more transparent. And so there is no question that we need to enhance the oversight over all attorneys in the state of New York. But they selected prosecutors because we seem to be, you know, currently in this tide of prosecutors and police being bad people. We seem to be those people responsible for mass incarceration, or at least that's the narrative. And so in an effort to seize upon that, they decided to carve out a special body that of political appointees that would have oversight over prosecutors, where people can file complaints without ever having to file them under the penalty of perjury. So in other words, you can lie about a particular prosecutor. You could be a defendant in a case and file a complaint, and that body would have oversight over the prosecutor. So I could be in the midst of prosecuting, let's say, a Sheldon Silver, and someone from his pack could file a complaint against me, and I would have to take my file and go before a body of people appointed by, you know, people like Sheldon Silver, and have to sit there and justify, you know, my conduct. And so we've sued, and we're currently in litigation. And we should anticipate, and before the new year, having the court provide us with some answer.
Well, call me cynical or Ishmael. You can call me anything you want, but I do have a suspicion that the reason that they're doing this is because they don't want you guys to be too aggressive, as you have just suggested, about their own misdoings.
Well, what's also interesting about that, and I would agree with your assessment, but what's interesting about that is only the prosecutors that had jurisdiction over them are the people that would come under this new law should it prevail. Meaning, in other words, that people who are appointed as special prosecutors, they don't come under the jurisdiction of this alphabet soup body. The Attorney General's office under Eric Schneiderman, who negotiated his way out of that particular legislation and then remained silent on the principles and the constitutionality of it.
And left under a cloud himself.
And left under a cloud himself. And so it's hypocrisy. And for those of you who watched the drama unfold in Capitol Hill with the Bob Mueller investigations and the kangaroo court of proceedings that took place, you know, run by politicians, that's exactly, you know, what you'd be getting from a commission on prosecutorial conduct. And we believe that we have the Constitution on our side. And I mean, and that's evidenced by the fact that the Attorney General's office, when asked for an opinion, agreed with us. But also the governor in his letter that looked more like a veto letter than it did a signing memo, also agreed with the constitutional points that we made. And the governor and many of the people who were part of that lawsuit agreed not to defend the constitutionality of the law. And so we're in this interesting space right now where we as prosecutors are in litigation, and the only remaining person deciding to defend the law on constitutional grounds happens to be the speaker.
Oh, that's interesting. So what has he got to worry about?
Well, I think, but you know something, Alan, what is so frustrating is the process now by which we are engaging in lawmaking, which I think is such a disservice to the citizens of the state of New York. And here's what I'm saying. You know, they want to say Commission on Prosecutorial Conduct because there's a lot of allegations of prosecutorial misconduct. That's really not true. When a judge makes a mistake in either sentencing or in a certain ruling, it's called judicial error. When a defense attorney fails to live up to, you know, his or her responsibility, it's called ineffective assistance of counsel. When a prosecutor makes a mistake, it's called prosecutorial misconduct, thereby inferring that there was something intentional in what that prosecutor did. And in fact, you know, cases in the appellate courts, cases in the Court of Appeals, more of them come back or more of them are reversed and ordered to be retried based upon ineffective assistance of counsel and judicial error more than they are on prosecutorial misconduct.
So, David Soares, I want to get to a couple of other things. One, everybody is talking about the elimination of cash bail. Could you explain the background on that and where we're going?
Lots of conversation on this. Now, what I will say is that the cash bail system in the state of New York is one that's needed to be looked at for a number of years. I mean, here's the reality. I mean, if you're engaged in a petty larceny or some minor crime, the idea that you would have to sit in jail and await, that case to process out is just absurd. And so, you know, we believe that there's perhaps 85% of all cases that are out there, specifically misdemeanor and nonviolent cases, judges should be letting people out and looking for the least restrictive means to assure that they return to court. And so we needed to engage in bail reform. And as a matter of fact, the DA's Association also supported a bail reform that was brought together. In fact, a series of proposals that were brought together by the Justice Task Force. And we were hoping that, of course, our legislature would have, you know, considered that and taken a look at it. And they did go about providing what they call reform on bail, except that they did so without any kind of funding. So it's going to be interesting to see as of January 1st, 2020, what the state of New York looks like.
So, but just to be clear about this, if somebody does, you know, physical violence, walks into a bodega or another place and takes out a gun and may even shoot somebody, shouldn't they be sitting in jail because they might, you know, do it a second time?
Those people should. And, you know, as of 2020, they still will be, because those are violent crimes. However, you know, take the scenario where your neighbor just decides to come out and punch you in the face.
Sure.
And he goes out and punches other people in your neighborhood in the face. Those would be misdemeanor crimes. And for those crimes, your neighbor would be arrested, brought to, he would be issued a desk appearance ticket. He would go to court and he would be let out, even though he continues to present a danger to all of you who live in the neighborhood. DAs stood for the position that a judge should be allowed to consider all of the facts and consider dangerousness in that situation, and then make a determination about bail.
So where does it stand now?
Well, the legislature says, nope, you give that person an appearance ticket. The legislature also said...
That's absurd.
Well, if someone breaks into your house and steals from you and is apprehended, the legislature also has just stated that that person should be allowed to continue to come back into your community until that case is resolved. So bail, they have eliminated cash bail for all of all misdemeanors and nonviolent felonies.
Well, the only thing I can say, having been, the victim of a minor crime, a guy comes up and he brings his car purposely onto our gardens and runs all over it. And then, you know, if that guy is mentally unstable or something like that, we can pretty well expect it. What about witness tampering? You know, in other words, you're always going to be afraid that that guy's coming back at you.
Well, you know, here's what I'm most offended by, I think, what's transpired. And that is... the New York State Legislature, which is their right, along with the governor, which is also his right, they're the people who draft our laws. But you know what? We used to live in a state and we used to live in a country where, you know, you have hearings and you hear from all of the stakeholders, even the ones that don't necessarily agree with me. But you create the opportunity to take testimony, to hear from subject matter experts, and then you begin crafting, you know, your legislation, considering all of what you've just, all the evidence that you've just absorbed. And that just didn't happen here. What we had was the beginning of session. We had a race to get these reforms in order. They're balancing between a number of different bills. There were no testimony taken from anyone. And then under the cover of darkness, on April 1st, you know, these bills were passed. And so
April 1st, that's April Fool's Day, isn't it?
It is April Fool's Day. And the joke's on us, because we now have until the beginning of the year to transform the entirety of the criminal justice system.
Let's talk about marijuana decriminalization. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I live in a very progressive state, Massachusetts. My little town of Great Barrington is going to have 5 pot shops. And New York State has been slow to the table, but we see an awful lot of New York licenses over here. So I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on this?
Look, I'm one of many that believe that, you know, the days of prosecuting marijuana cases should end.
Sure.
If the people of the state of New York desire to have a market-regulated economy for marijuana, then by the way, I'm all for it. You know, I do say so with the caveat of, you know, making sure that we invest enough resources to make sure that marijuana is not getting in the hands of young people. And I also, you know, do so under the caveat that we invest in resources to make sure that the roadways that we share as a society remain free and unencumbered by, you know, drunk drivers or drug drivers.
We don't have that yet, right, David?
What we don't have are those considerations. We haven't even begun that debate here.
If a driver is drunk, we're going to know it. They can take a test. But we don't have that for marijuana, do we?
No, the technology for marijuana is not where it needs to be. are tests that we can take that will allow us to know whether or not there's THC in the blood, but there's no test right now that would conclusively determine whether or not a person's driving has been hampered by THC, because THC is absorbed so fast from the blood and into the brain, thereby causing, you know, the impaired reactions. And so until we develop such a test, or we can craft laws that allow for presumptions, you know, then
what do you mean presumptions?
Well, if you have THC in your blood, you know, then there's a presumption that you are operating a vehicle with some impairment. So I do think that this is an issue that once you hear from the stakeholders, and, you know, you can, in fact, craft and do so successfully. This shouldn't be the reason we don't have a market-regulated economy. And I only say that because, look, we are a state that is surrounded. Every single New England state has some form of market-regulated marijuana or medical marijuana. We have a country that exists right above us that has legalized marijuana. And so it's
illegalized. In other words, there's an awful lot of it out there that people are making money from.
Oh, yeah. And so the only thing that can happen from us continuing to put off this issue is to have a dark economy that is just going to be very robust,
sure,
which will then cause other states to increase their exports to this state. And it would create chaos in the sense that we will now be responsible for prosecuting and arresting these people. And that's not really the direction we want to go.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. I mentioned before that there are an awful lot of New York license plates at our pot shops here in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, basically on the border. But those folks are not supposed to be buying, are they?
No, they're not. And you know, in Albany, we established a policy after, you know, much deliberation. We spoke to our residents all over the county. And you know what? Prosecuting low-level offense possession cases is just not where we want to be.
Right.
Not to mention the kind of resources that it takes up in terms of having to have things tested. And again, it's really it's absurd to think that, look, man, you're in your neighborhood. You're the only one that is not allowing for this kind of, you know, market economy to exist, but you're surrounded by it, and then somehow you're going to prevent it from coming through your doors. It's just not realistic.
I want to go back to something, you know, we discussed earlier, but it seems to be very important. There's a great deal of political corruption. We all know it, you know, in the legislature and people surrounding the governor's office. The governor has not been accused of it, but some of his closest people have gone to jail as a result of this, or are going. So my question to you is, since you are underfunded and since you are supposed to be the guy who is looking at the political corruption, and since it always turns out to, so no, it's a long question, it always turns out to be the FBI and the feds who come in, should people be demanding that the legislature give you more money for your office?
People should be demanding, you know, tighter, well-crafted pieces of legislation that prevent the conduct that currently exists. One of the most difficult and complex challenges for a state prosecutor in looking at corruption is, what is the difference between someone who is making political contributions and you're turning around and providing favors for that person? What is the difference between, you know, the legitimacy and the illegitimacy of that behavior? It's the way that the statute is crafted. Now, what kills me is that when it comes to marijuana, when it comes to weapons, you know, our legislature is so great that they can really craft legislation right down to the measure of a barrel of a gun or the ounce or the milligram of a particular product. But they cannot seem to craft legislation that eliminates the loopholes for political contribution and bribery. And that's really a shame, which is one of the number one reasons we continue to use our colleagues in the federal system, whose laws are much better than ours. And that's why you see the number of referrals going from state prosecutors to the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Okay, I want to get you to one more important thing. The Albany Police Chief, Eric Hawkins, has been dealing with incidents, including a video that surfaced this week of police removing an African-American woman from her car in a traffic stop. The chief says the police body camera video showed police acted professionally when compared to the citizen video. What do you make of that?
Well, that's what you're going to find in most instances. What you're seeing on social media are snippets and portions that are played from the viewpoint of a phone of a citizen who just happens to be standing there taking it, taking the video. The citizen's taking that video without any kind of context and without any knowledge of what is appropriate police conduct. Now, here's the thing. If a police approaches you and asks you to remove yourself from a car, and they do so 20 to 30 times, you are supposed to remove yourself from that vehicle. If you refuse to pull yourself from that vehicle, and then the officers are using force, if you hold on to your steering wheel, an officer is authorized to use force to extricate you from that vehicle. Now, the question becomes, is the use of that force reasonable under the circumstances? Well, if you see three or four police officers trying to pull a person away, and the only thing that that person is doing is holding on to a steering wheel, well, then using an open hand and striking that person in the arm in an effort to try to have them release their grip, that would be considered under the law a reasonable use of force.
We're out of time. Our guest has been Albany County District Attorney David Soares. Again, David, thank you so much for joining us. We hope that we'll see you again in the near future.
Thank you.